This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Also sponsored by Windstar Farm. Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, Pontiff of the Pick Four. We are in our Lexington, Kentucky studios and want to welcome everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220, XM Channel 206, and of course, all of you tuning in worldwide on our website, on your smartphone, your tablet, whatever it might be, with our live streaming at horseracingradio.net. JT, good evening, my friend.
Greetings.
Another fun show on tap for this evening.
Happy and delighted to have Dan Hendricks on board. He's one of the greatest guys you ever want to meet. He comes from a distinguished family of horsemen, and we've been friends for longer than probably he cares to remember.
Well, Dan Hendricks is indeed our special guest on Trainer Talk this evening. He's a native of Los Angeles, California, just celebrated his 57th birthday on December 5th, and he's a man who has recorded 710 wins in a career that is still going strong. His runners have earned more than $30 million in purses, and he's with us now on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Happy to have you on board. And boy, some lofty numbers there, $30 million in purses. Where's all the money?
I'd like to know myself. I think I need to have a talk with my bookkeeper.
It's amazing, that total. That's awesome. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I think I've had over 100 stakes winners, and it's just fun to kind of look back and see how it's all added up.
Could you ever imagine, Dan, when you first got started with horses and with training, that it would end up here with those kind of accolades?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, I just started galloping horses because I was, you know, old enough to get a license and my family was all in it. So, you know, I just wanted something to do. It seemed like a good job, work 4 hours in the morning and make a living. And it just kind of steamrolled from there to Willard Proctor, luckily, for 2 years. It taught me a lot and, you know, how to behave on the track and take care of business. And then I really got lucky to hook up with Dick Mandela, and that just, you know, kind of got it all started.
Well, talk about your dad for a minute. He was an unbelievable horseman, and other trainers used to send him horses with problems, with difficulties, and he would fix them up. He was a horse whisperer long before that term became popular. Talk about him a minute.
Well, I can't say enough about him. I owe my career to him because it helped his family name. But, you know, he started at his young age with his twin brother, and their mom got him a couple horses, and they just started learning how to teach them tricks. They never had a horse before. And you know, when they were 12, 14 years old, they were jumping them over a post with no bridle and saddle and teaching them to roll over. And, you know, they just understood horses and animals. And throughout their career, they had everything from, you know, coyotes and dogs and horses and mules and all sorts of different animals that they taught and turned into a rodeo act that they took all over the country from, you know, California to Madison Square Garden. And they were known as one of the best, if not the best, rodeo act ever. And it was very nice to have them inducted into the Rodeo Hall of Fame last year.
for talking about your father, Lee, and your uncle, Byron, and what a team that they made up together.
Yeah, and also with my mom. They all three did it for about 15 years on the road, and they even made movies. They had a full-length movie featuring their horses called The Gallant Best in 1946, and they were in the first 3D rodeo western movie called Rodeo that featured their acts, and they worked with Gene Autry and just all sorts of people, and it was quite the life, I guess you could say.
Do you ever utilize any of their tricks in your training program?
Well, you know, I'm embarrassed to say I'm not anywhere near the horsemen they were, but you know, when I get problems with horses or situations come up, I actually still call them. And after Ohm ran in the ocean side this summer, my dad called me and asked me a couple things and came up with something that I used that, you know, obviously helped him in the next two races. And, you know, so I always try to use them and the knowledge you have. 10 years ago, I even had him come out at 80 years old and get on a racehorse for me, and he straightened them out in about 10 minutes.
Wow. Well, that's outstanding. What did he tell you about Om that led to the improved performance?
Well, if I told you that, anyone could
do it. He's not giving away the secrets. That's like the KFC family recipe, right?
Yeah.
He's not letting it out of the bag.
No, basically, you know, what he told me was he acted up for the race, and a little in the gate. Yeah, how he was in the gate. And I told him, you know, he's pretty so good. And, you know, sometimes practice just take them every day and stand them. Don't do anything other than stand them, and just keep them calm in there. Make them think that it's no big deal, you know. And I did that, and the next time he ran, the next two times he was perfect. And so, you know. It's just little things, and he still sees them just from watching Cal race, watching on TVG. So, you know, he's still a big help to me. You know, I can't say enough about him. He used to look for horses that had problems and fix them, and they got started on the track with a horse named Indolto that was related to typecast or convenience. And real well-bred horse that was barred off two tracks in New York, and he wouldn't break, so they caught him, and that's the horse that got him started on the track.
He was a real fast horse in Dolto.
He was. They got him, and they ran him. I think he set a track record at Hollywood Park going 5.5, and my dad said he was never out broke after they had him.
Wow, spectacular. Did your mom and dad want you to be involved with horses, Dan?
They never pushed it on me. You know, they got me a pony when we were 2 years old, and me and my brother and sister, and we rode them around like they were bicycles all around Ranch Santa Fe growing up. And, you know, I just rode a little when I was young, and it wasn't until I got back to the track that I started back, you know, with the horses, but... unfortunately, that's right when my dad retired is when I started.
What was the moment where you said, hey, this is what I want to do for a living?
You know, I went to work for Proctor for 2 years and then Mandela for almost 10. And you know, about 5 years into working for Richard, I realized that, you know, whatever he said, he was good to his word about. And he said if I ever wanted to get started, he'd help me out. So it wasn't until I was his assistant and working for him for a while, you know, that I started thinking that I could, you know, train. But it never was a life goal or anything like that. It's just something that happened and, you know, just came about. And, you know, it just worked out really well. And he let me have some horses the last year or so that I trained for his offspring for him. And it just snowballed from there. And then when I went on my own, I actually, you know, I had 7 horses and won a stake the first meet I started.
I remember one day being on the rail with Richard, and some people came up to him and wanted to give him a horse or two. I can't remember if it was one or two, but anyway, the first words out of his mouth were, you know, I really think you should give those horses to Dan Hendricks. And I was blown away just because, you know, it's so hard to get started. And here, you know, these people were new clients, and he just, like, right off the bat, he said, you know, I think you should give those horses to Dan Hendricks. And he went into his speech about you and what kind of guy you were and what kind of horseman you were. And my God, I wanted to give you my horses after I heard that. it was unbelievable. I thought it was like one of the classiest things that I ever encountered on the racetrack.
They must not have been very well bred.
Well, you know, I don't know if it was even at that point where he was all that picky, you know. But
he's done it right since the beginning, and I, like I said, I was just real lucky to fall into, you know, galloping for him, freelancing, and he offered me a steady job, and within a month he asked if I wanted to be his assistant. And like I said, I can remember things he told me the first week or month that held true throughout the whole time, and I can't say enough for him helping me in my career. You know, there's certain people, you know, besides my dad, and Mandela and Wygod, Martin Wygod, that gave me horses early that, you know, you don't, you know, expect them or think that you might get it, opportunities from people like that. But, you know, it just really sets a tone for your career and helps out because, you know, I just learned how to do it right, how to keep ahead of the books, and not get behind my business that way, and it helps, and how to treat the horses, because if he always told me, you treat the horses right, the owners will be happy, and if the owners are happy, then you'll be happy.
Trainer Dan Hendricks joining us on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Dan, talk about those differences in working with a guy like Willard Proctor and then going to work for Richard, both of them legendary in their own right, but I'm sure that they had two different approaches to running their business and to training horses.
Well, everyone does, and, you know, Willard was, I guess, what you'd call really old school, and those horses came first no matter what, and, you know, it was just very basic good horsemanship that and hard, diligent work, and it helped me a lot as a 16-year-old wild little kid that, you know, didn't know where he was going. And I think a couple of years for him, it was the best thing could have happened to me. And I didn't really follow how he trained and that much, but more of just that he, you know, was diligent with his horses and such a good horseman that you could learn from just being around him. And then going to work for Richard is, He's got the old school and the new modern training, and a lot of things Richard did was, you know, he'd try new things, you know, whether there were different sorts of bandages or, you know, how to train a horse, whether it was, you know, walking them a mile around the racetrack before you trained them, or whether you put a big set of blinkers on them and made them aggressive, you know, it just, whatever it took on a certain individual horse, and both those guys were, you know, trained each horse individually. And, you know, that's the best thing you could learn, not have a factory where every single horse gallops the exact same way every day.
Yeah, he is an innovator and a guy that, I asked him if he thought he was single-minded and contemplative of his horses, and he says, what does that mean? But I think he is that way. And I mean, I used to just clock his action at Del Mar when I was stabled next to him, and I learned a lot of things from him that were really rather avant-garde that you wouldn't think a guy like Richard Mandela might, like, train a horse in the paddock at Del Mar, literally gallop a horse in the paddock. I'd never seen that done before. And I used that down the road and won a couple races with the filly who really didn't like to go to the racetrack. And just little things like that he would do, you know, and it didn't seem like such a big deal to him at the time. I guess it was just that he thought about the horse and how can I get this horse to do what I want it to do, you know. And I think that's a magnificent trait that he has that a lot of other trainers don't.
No, he grew up on a farm with a horse store as a dad. He broke horses when he was 14 years old, and you know he learned how to do things from start to finish. And like I said, you know, being around a guy like that, you know, a lot of it rubs off, and it's really just basic stuff. But when you add it up and do little things, you know, it can make a big difference from you know, a horse winning a race or not. And you know, I learned to try things like that, like schooling a horse in the morning and afternoon, and even once I had a horse that was so bad, I'd school him in the first race if he was running in a late enough race, you know, and things like that. You just got to try different things and do different things with each horse, and you know, you have a basic program from all, but you know, when you can take each one and do it individually, that little extra thing, like you said, whether it's coming off the track with a horse and instead of just taking the tack right off, you might ride them around the barn for 10 minutes, or like you said, the paddock, or you know, that. And it really adds up and makes a difference.
How much time do you still spend with Richard and maybe talking horses or other topics as well, but how much time do you still spend with him, Dan?
Well, I still call him up like my dad, and I ask him and put things in, you know, in situations in front of him and say, you know, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? And, you know, he says, well, what do you think you should do? He doesn't just tell me what I should do. He actually will ask me, what do you think you should do? And half the time I'll tell him, and he'll say, you're right, you know, do that. And or he'll say, well, try this. And I've even had him come over and, you know, look at the horses with me just because I can. And, you know, it's like going to the library still and being able to pull out the dictionary or, you know, the book that gets you the answers. So as long as he's put up with me, I'll keep doing it. And, you know, we got a good relationship. I see him every morning and his son, Gary, and we, you know, I talk every day almost. And when he ships a horse and stuff, sometimes I call him and talk to him and give him a hard time about going away. And, you know, like I said, I think it was when I won the Del Mar Derby. He was waiting near the paddock for me. He didn't even have a horse in the race. But he went down there to congratulate me. And, you know, it's besides working for him, it's he's one of my best friends.
I can imagine that you had to be around some amazing horses in those years with Richard. Tell me about some of the horses, Dan, that you kind of became fond of and that you're always going to remember.
Well, working for Richard, tell you the truth, I went to work for him. He had 18 horses, and I think he had Bad and Big was his one stake horse. He had another maybe. And, you know, we went through a lot of horses. Pirate's Bounty was one of my favorites, even though he didn't do that much or run that much, but he came from Lefty Nickerson, and that Dick had worked for it as an assistant, and Richard trained him, and I galloped him, and that was a really neat horse. He was very high strung and full of himself, and then I ended up training a lot of his babies, so he's one of my all-time favorites. And he had a horse named Hopeful Word that was really, really strong, tough to gallop, and won some races. Not great horses, but just horses to remember. Other than that, you know, there's a lot of them. Can't really pinpoint. There was three, Mama San, Menswear, and Poli, three brothers, and they all won stakes and ran really well, all out of the same mare. So they were really neat. But not really name horses you remember from their accolades, more the horses that were characters and, you know, had a lot of unique things about them that made you remember them is the ones I remember more than, you know, the big name horses. And he really hit his own a few years after I had left him, probably when I got out of the way, is when he started getting men's, you know, gentlemen and all those horses like that.
Yeah, people sometimes forget, you know, he wasn't an overnight sensation or anything. He paid his dues. I mean, we talked about that with him before the Breeders' Cup and all those Truxton Kings he used to train, and he was a two-year-old trainer. And then, you know, you say he only had 18 horses when you went to work for him, you know, it took him a while to get going. But, man, once he found his best stride, he was all over but the shouting. It was amazing. He had such a great run for a long, long time with just horse after horse after horse. They just seemed to, like, flow to him.
Yeah, and he's still not done. I mean, look what he's done with Beholder.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Some others lately. So it's not like he's, you know, he just, the difference with him and some of the bigger trainers is he's never let himself get so many horses he couldn't individually train each one. So he keeps his numbers down, and, you know, they're you're not going to see him winning, you know, 500 races a year. He'd rather win the quality races and keep it in a smaller number that he can control and enjoy. And he deserves it. He's done enough in his career that he can do it the way he wants to do, and it's obviously works.
You mentioned Marty Wygod. Was he your first client when you went out on your own?
No, I met him when, you know, Richard had trained for him, and then they split up, and I'd been training for about a year or so, and I was thinking, man, where am I going? I got 15 horses and not much going on, and, you know, I was hoping for an owner like him, and he came up to me and asked if I wanted to train for him, and I just jumped it. It was like, you know, what an opportunity. And at the time he had, you know, leading sires in California and that. And we started winning races and, you know, it just snowballed from there. But he really got me going, and I owe a lot of my career to him too. He just fed me a lot of horses, and we won a lot of stakes over the years. And, you know, Private Persuasion won my first grade one, and Feverish was just a really neat horse that I had for him that never missed a check, and the only time she ran worse than third was when me or Eddie De La Husse messed her up.
That's a potent combo.
Talking with trainer Dan Hendricks on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Dan, so when you finally decided to go out on your own in the late 80s, how did you know the timing was right to give it a shot?
I think Richard was a little tired of me being around for so long. So, you know, he helped me get a couple horses. I just got real lucky that I got a little filly named Tulang, but I had two or three when I was working for him and had a few more come up. It was just time, and the opportunity was right. It just worked out really well because I was able to, you know, start winning races right away the first meet or two I was at. And, you know, you were right there with me, Chute. We were stable near each other at Del Mar.
Yep. Yeah, it doesn't seem like that long ago, but I guess it was, you know?
Yeah, it's more years than we want to
count. Yeah, I mean, you're like most trainers. You remember all the horses that you trained and how you trained them. And you know, people always are baffled by that, but it's such a part of your life, and when you're in it, you know, the days go so fast. I mean, it's just unbelievable. But I look back on it now, and it doesn't seem like it's that long ago.
Yeah, I remember when 57-year-old guy seemed like a really old man.
Yeah, I can't believe you're younger than me.
Yeah.
I go, he's only 57.
Dan, you know, you mentioned the name Tulang, and that had to be a very special horse for you, provided you with your first stakes win, if I'm not mistaken, back in 87 after you went out on your own.
I was very lucky. Hal Oliver, I worked with him at the early stage of my career, and he got me Dr. Jones and his wife for clients, and Tulang's one of the first horses he gave me, and we broke her maiden, and then I was lucky enough to win a race with Bill Shoemaker riding on her. And then he couldn't ride her in the stake at Del Mar, so I got Eddie Delahoussaye to ride her. And that was my first stakes win.
Yeah, we have that in common, too. Shoemaker rode my horse, and I won my first grade one at San Anita with Delahoussaye. I guess he was the go-to guy if you couldn't get Shoe, huh?
yeah. Well, back then, I mean, we had seemed like 10 Hall of Fame riders in the room at one time. Unbelievable jockey colony back then.
Yeah, it was crazy. McCarron was in here over the weekend, and we were talking about that. The riders were just, one was just as good as another. I mean, I remember one time I was in a stakes race, and I put Alex Solis on the horse, and the owner went crazy. He goes, that's the best you could do?
Yeah, future Hall of Famer.
Yeah, it's like you got to be kidding me, you know. So it was deep. It was a luxury for us, really, because no matter who you put on your horse, they were going to be good. You know, you didn't really have to worry about jocks. You always had the guys that you gravitated to, guys you were lucky with, guys you had a rapport with. But there were plenty of riders that had lots of talent there.
Yeah, and we're lucky still. We still got a great group out here, and you know, all over the country. There's just some, you know, outstanding riders. It makes your job easy, but it's just fun to look back and see how as they, you know, retired, the new ones come up. Before you know it, they're the great ones.
Dan, we have to get to a break in just about a minute or so, but in about a minute, sum up what made Eddie Delahoussaye such a good rider.
You know, he just, his patience, and he thought about what was coming up and what he needed to do in a race during the race. You know, he's like one of the only riders you see let horses pass him on the backside. You know, how many jocks you see will be going down the backside and someone makes an early move and they go with him. You know, and they, instead of just saying, yeah, go ahead. I'll see you at the wire when I'm going by you, you know. And Eddie, you know, he was known for coming from behind, but he just let a horse get into his stride, and when the horse wanted to run, then he'd say, okay, let's go. And you know, horse, I think, really appreciated that. And then, you know, as much as he was known as coming from behind and winning by a nose, he could fall out on the lead and win more races than a lot of jocks could. I remember Smooth Player, she got off slow in her first start. We always were taking her back, ran her in the Hollywood Oaks at about 10-1, 15-1 against Excellent Meeting, who was even money, and he fell out on the lead, just never looked back. From then on, that's what she did, and we won a lot of races that way. He could just ride any horse, any style, and was a great guy anyway.
Dan Hendricks, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. We're going to continue this visit right after this short break, and we'll look back at so many of the other stars that Dan's been around through his stellar career. We'll do that next, second half of Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. For your best chance at success, shop Fasic Tipton Selected Sales. Annually ranked at the top of all major North American sales by percentage of Grade 1 winners and graded stakes winners produced, that trend continued at the 2015 Breeders' Cup World Championships. Fasic Tipton Selected Sales grads won 6 Breeders' Cup races at Keeneland, with victories by such stars as American Pharoah, Stop Charging Maria, Songbird, Nyquist, Teppan, and Waybell Avenue. Fasic Tipton Selected Sales. Where will you be? For more information, please visit FasicTipton.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Russell Mayan, one of the nation of class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
And they're off to New York. the premier state bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
Kale Density announces a revolutionary gastrointestinal guard and aid for all classes and all ages of horses. A natural registered animal feed product, it comes as a single dose disposable syringe or a handy top dress squeeze pouch. Field trials on Kale Density Digestive Aid have returned 100% favorable results as observed by their trainers and owners, and the cost is half of what horsemen are accustomed to paying. Kale Density Digestive Aid will be available in mid-November, or you can order online at caldensity.com.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
A quarter of a mile to go now, and Brother Derek hasn't been asked to run yet. AP Warriors trying to make a race of it. Point determined third. Homeward Bound in the big one, and Brother Derek just gets the rein, shaking it in, and he glides past the eight ball here. And Brother Derek well on his way to a very, very impressive win in the San Juanita Derby. Next up, Kentucky Derby for the son of Benchmark. Brother Derek Kent is up. Point determined second, then AP Warrior. And he'll be a photo before Sacred Light and Wild Fang.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. That clip you just heard coming out of the commercial break, Brother Derek winning the Santa Anita Derby. One of so many outstanding horses that trainer Dan Hendricks has had the privilege to be around in his career, and we're going to talk to him about Brother Derek and so many of the other big names that he's been around in just a minute as we continue this visit on Trainer Talk. Mike Penna, Jude Feld in our Lexington studios, and do want to extend a welcome back to everybody tuning in on our website, horseracingradio.net. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of this program, you can go back to our website and you can listen to the podcast at your leisure. That is also available on iTunes. Just search Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Fun first half of the program, JT.
Yeah, it's great. I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, and really excited to talk with Dan about Brother Derek and the other great horses he's been around. And Dan, when you think about Brother Derek and everything that he accomplished, boy, what a special horse. You had to just kind of pinch yourself every day when you went to the barn.
Yeah, you know, the thing about him was I bought his brother the year before, Don't Sell Me Short, 2 years before, out of the Barrett's March sale. And he was Calbrit, two-year-old of the year type horse, and won some stakes. So when we went back to sell, Cecil Peacock obviously wanted me to look at his brother. And his Breeze was one of the best I've ever seen at a training sale. And all I thought about up until the time we got him was, are we going to be able to afford him? You know, what can we pay for a Calbred, you know, by this new sire Benchmark? And that was one of Mr. Wygod's. And, you know, luckily we went to 275 and got him. And it wasn't the first Breeze that he came back to the barn, and I told the rider, I said, he's something special, isn't he? And he said, oh, I don't want to say anything yet. No, it's too early. I said, I'm telling you, this is as nice a horse as I've had. And, you know, he broke his maiden first time out and went on and did all the good he did. And just a great horse to work with. He was just, you know, so fluid. The stride he had and everything and the speed was a real dominant factor in racing. And had a lot of fun with him.
What attracted you other than the fact that you had his brother? Was he a better type or why did you covet him so much?
Well, first is mechanics. First thing I do it with training cells, look at the workouts. And his mechanics were just really good, and he did it so easy. And he went a fast eighth, went out a quarter in 20 and 4/5, but I also clocked him out 3/8 and 32 and 4/5.
Wow.
And he would have gone on even more had they let him look, you know. So that I really loved. And then he came back the next week. We used to have two breed shows back then, and they said he was just going to gallop, and he just about worked 10 and 4 in a gallop. And that just scared me that I wouldn't be able to afford him. But his mechanics and the way he moved on the track were as good as any horse I'd seen. And then confirmation-wise, he was really good. I mean, he had tiny little turnout or, you know, a little something. It wasn't even enough that I can remember now, but confirmation was good. And then, you know, the breeding. The mare had, you know, a lot of foals, but a lot of winners. And the one we obviously had had won stakes, so that's another plus. And I just, you know, you add up all those things, and, you know, that's the kind of horses I like to try to buy. And I've been real lucky at the two-year-old sales, getting horses like Rigoletta to win a grade one and Irish Surf to set a track record and win a great race. And, Ohm, he's won a couple graded stakes from two-year-old sales and quite a few others. So, you know, I just try to add up everything. All their positives. They don't have to be the best looking, the biggest, the fastest. But, you know, in confirmation and the way they act around the barn when you're looking at them and how they take the pressure, you add all those things up. And that's what tells you, you know, you got a good shot at getting a good horse.
Of course, brother Derek won 6 of 17 lifetime starts, more than $1.6 million in person earnings in that career. And he was actually second choice in the 2006 Kentucky Derby. Tell me about that experience, Dan, of showing up at the Derby with a horse that highly regarded.
It was unbelievable to see, you know, what went into that race. You watch it on TV, but you don't get the feeling of you land in Kentucky and, you know, as soon as you get there, there's 20, 30 photographers, and that's 10 days out, a week out. And it just, you know, goes from there to more people, more pressure, more radio shows, TV shows, you know, interviews. And I got lucky, you know, with Cecil. He had such a great attitude going into any race, even the Derby. You know, his attitude was, well, if we don't win, you know, someone has to run second. Or, you know, there's no pressure with training for him. It was all, you know, thankful that we have the opportunity to be in that position and just wanted to enjoy it. He brought 24 of his friends, and I brought 20 friends. And, you know, win, lose, or draw, we were going to just enjoy the day and enjoy just being in that opportunity. And it was great. It really was a lot of fun. And anyone that has that opportunity should do it, because it is horse racing it's all about. You know, you ask anyone on the street, name something about horse racing, and, you know, it's Bill Shoemaker and the Kentucky Derby are the two things that most people can name.
Well, it's always good to go into a big race with a shot. Talk about the race itself a little bit.
Well, the Derby we drew outside, which was the only, you know, like, bad thing before the race that ever came up with that horse. I thought it was the end of the world, and of course Cecil's reply was, well, somebody has to run at least. You know, so the whole time going into the race, Alex and I and he talked about, you know, the scenario of the race and all this, a lot of the derbies, they just go so fast up front. We didn't want to get into that kind of pace duel. And he broke really well, and Alex took a little hold, perfect, sat, you know, looked like he was going to be able to sit just behind maybe what was some silly speed. And all of a sudden, when we turned down the backside, he just got swallowed up. I mean, he went from laying in a good outside fifth position to 15th, I think, in an eighth mile, it seemed like. And I thought it was over going into the second turn. And, you know, he got him around some horses, and he made a big move about eight wide. And he really ran his heart out after being, you know, everything going his way with short fields, no one pressing him on the front end, winning each race easy, to coming from behind in a 20-horse field. And I couldn't have been prouder of him running fourth. And Cecil was happy. We had a good time. And it was great.
Trainer Dan Hendricks joining us on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton here on HRRN. Dan, you mentioned the name Bill Shoemaker on a couple of occasions here throughout the show. And Bill Shoemaker is somebody that you kind of almost leaned on in terms of his story when you had your accident back in 2004, which left you paralyzed and in a wheelchair. Bill Shoemaker had a similar scenario where he came back to training after his accident, or started training after his accident, and he did that in a wheelchair, had some success, and I know that's one person you kind of looked toward when you had your accident. Is that true?
It is. I mean, he showed me that you could do it. He had a very big, successful barn. He got hurt and kept training with it. And, you know, it did help to see that it could be done. And, having someone in a wheelchair training before I got hurt, you know, obviously made me think that I could do it too. And I looked up to Bill, you know, forever. I took him to the gate when he won with Exceller in the Hollywood Gold Cup, and had him ride a winner for me. And over the years, I also, you know, just saw the way he treated people. He'd walk down the roads in the barn area, and he'd talk to a groom or a hot walker or a trainer, and he treated them all the same with respect. And, you know, I hope that throughout my career, you know, I tried to do that, and I remember that too. And then, you know, the way he rode horses. So, you know, Bill was a bigger influence on more people than you'd imagine, just, you know, being a jockey alone, let alone training and let alone the adversity you went through.
Well, I can't even imagine how difficult that point in your life must have been for you. And you were right back to training in just a short period of time. What brought you back to the racetrack, and what got you through that difficult time?
Well, it's more that the racetrack brought me back, and the racetrack kept me busy. And it is hard to go through something like that. And it just, I got thrown back into it, and I didn't have a choice. You know, it's go out 7 days a week and be thrown out in front of people. And 2 years after I got hurt or so, you know, I got brother Derek and thrown into the limelight with that. You know, and really it is what helped me. That and my three boys are the two things that helped me get through the injury more than anything.
Well, one thing I got to say, though, the whole time you never really changed your attitude, at least not at the racetrack. I don't know what you thought about when you went home at night, but you were the same person going in and coming out. I mean, just always a good attitude, smile on your face, talking, you know, trash at the rail, whatever it was. I mean, you never really missed a beat.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean about 7 days a week and going out and people, you know, it's a real good family we have at the racetrack. It's hard work and 7 days a week, but, you know, it's a lot of good people to fall back on and have your back. And that helped me get through it, and I couldn't have done it without everyone's support.
Dan, I read somewhere that one of the things that you missed most about being – paralyzed and now being in a wheelchair was that you are now unable to gallop horses, obviously. And is that true? Is that the one thing that really kind of got to you and said, boy, I wish I could gallop some horses again?
Well, there's a couple other things with being a family show. I won't get into that. but basically, yeah, you know, it was really good when training a horse and, you know, a horse would act up or do something and I could get on him or go out even just with the pony on him and, you know, do some little things with him. And I do miss that part of it. And it's just something I need to communicate to my riders. And, you know, my son now is galloping for me. And, you know, I try to talk to him and tell him that, you know, I've been, you know, galloped for 30 years and try this, try that. And he listens to me sometimes and it works out real well. So, you know, you just have to change up what you were doing to what you can do now. And that's what I did. But galloping horses was fun. It was, you know, the day in and day out, 7 days a week, it wears on you. But, you know, when you work a horse and they work really well, or you gallop a horse and teach them to do something, it's very satisfying. And as a trainer, it's an added tool.
You know, for people that may not realize, Dan was not injured in a racing accident. It was a motocross accident, which was his hobby at that time. And Dan, you mentioned your one son that gallops for you, and you said the three boys were so instrumental in helping you get through that difficult period. Are the other two involved in racing in any way?
No, this is my youngest son that gallops horses, and my older boys just never had the interest. They just, you know, had things they were doing, and I think they were around the horses and the track when they were a little younger, and, you know, it was just there, and they didn't have any interest in it, so they went on. My middle son's in the Navy, and my oldest son's running a Starbucks, so, you know, they're happy and doing what they want to do, and that's what I'd rather do. I didn't push my youngest to come to the track. He just gravitated to it because he wanted to. And I think that's the best way for someone to end up at the racetrack, because you got to love it to do it.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I mean, it is a way of life. It's a lifestyle choice, and you know, it's not the easiest on your family sometimes. But if you love the horses and you love the racing, there's really no place you'd rather be.
No, it's great. It's great. It's, I mean, you're working outdoors and you're working with horses, and, you know, if you can just step back, you've been there at Santa Anita, and step back and enjoy the sunrise some mornings, or, you know, step back and take a look at your horse and say, you know what, it's pretty cool what we do.
Yeah, the mornings at Santa Anita, there's really nothing like them. I mean, you know, I like to go to the Caribbean and all the Caribbean sunsets and sunrises and stuff. They're great. But I'll tell you, that first step out on the apron at Santa Anita, almost every morning you're there, is just breathtaking. I mean, it's just amazing, you know, when the sun comes up there, how beautiful it is. And you really do have that thankful feeling that you're there and you're doing what you love. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, you got the backdrops with the mountains, and, you know, and what a lot of people don't realize is the public can come out, get a cup of coffee at Clocker's Corner and enjoy that themselves, and they don't have to do it 7 days a week.
That's right.
Dan, do you think your youngest son will eventually want to get into training horses?
Yeah, I think he would like to. You know, he's taking the approach I think I did. He's, you know, taking advantage of being able to work and make a living at this point without the pressure of having to do it. And he's learning a lot. You know, he might end up soon going to work for someone else to get an idea how other barns run. And if he wants to do it, you know, more power to him, and I'll support him. And if he doesn't, that's fine. He's going to college at nights, and that's you know, good, because he can maybe learn some things from that and use that in another career. So, you know, the racetrack teaches you a lot other than just training horses, and I think it's a good school for any business you'd end up in. So I'm real happy he's working with me and enjoying it, and you know, hopefully he'll do what he wants to do, and I'll be behind him whatever it is.
Well, it's interesting you would say that about the racetrack, because so often with trainers that appear on this program, we'll ask them what advice they might give to a younger trainer that's just getting started in the game or looking to get into the profession. What things have you told your son about training horses and what this profession is all about, Dan?
That you have to be dedicated to it. It's not something you can just take for granted. You have to, you know, number one, love doing it and love horses, because if you don't take care of them, they won't take care of you. And if you can do that and do things and with that in mind, you should be successful if things fall in line for you and you get lucky. And you got to get lucky in this business, you know, whether it's getting a first client or winning those first few races to get some, you know, publicity that you can get some new clients. You know, without that, you're just not gonna, you know, get rolling, and that's what you have to get doing early.
Earlier, you talked about the business end of horse racing and how you've always been able to maintain that business acumen in your operation. Talk about that and how important that is for a young trainer.
Well, I learned that. It's another thing, you know, besides horse training that I learned from Richard. He said, stay ahead of your bills when you can, because then when it does get lean and you start falling behind, then you're just going to be even or a little behind. And it's easier to catch up that way. And that helped me a lot. And then I got real lucky with, you know, I've only had two bookkeepers, one retired, and then I heard Pete Belanta, the bookkeeper to a lot of 10, 15 trainers. And, you know, I got real lucky to get in with Pete and have somebody I could trust and help me, you know, take care of the business part of it that I missed in school.
Dan Hendricks, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Dan, another horse name that you've mentioned a couple of times is Om, and he is still in training with you, and he has some bragging rights, or at least he did until Keen Ice came along in the Traverse. He was the only horse to defeat Triple Crown winner American Pharoah, and he did it at odds of 22-1 in American Pharoah's debut at Del Mar. How cool was it to at least be able to have those bragging rights for a little while?
Well, I still got a little bit of bragging rights. Only two horses won races that he ran in, and I was the first one to do it. But, you know, it's been fun, and, you know, we go back and forth with Baffert and I and about it. And, you know, he says, I just ran too fast for him. And, you know, and when he won at Del Mar, it was a lot of fun, because he just really just laid it down and won in a great time. Couldn't believe how many people called up and were trying to buy him. Luckily, Mr. Shireen didn't want to sell him, and we were able to keep him. And, you know, we're still running, and he's doing great right now. He's going to run opening day at Santa Anita.
Yeah, I saw that he had a really good breeze the other day. And was it yesterday or was it today? When did he breeze last?
He breezed this morning, three quarters, 114 and change, just like we wanted, a little aggressive in the beginning, so Gary didn't press him too hard the last part, but he's doing really well. Gary says he feels great, and he's just full of himself, and he is just like an Energizer bunny. I mean, you bring him out, and his ears are twitching, and tail's swishing, and he just feels full of himself all the time, and he's a lot of fun to train. And besides that, he's about the most photogenic horse you're going to get, with the blaze and the white socks and, you know, the deep red color. And he's got a real thick mane on him, kind of like an old school horse that, you know, he just looks the part, he acts the part, and he's run well. So I couldn't be happier with him.
Dan, last week we were joined by John Paracella on this program, and a lot of people call him the trainer to the stars because he's been associated with so many big-name celebrities. You had the opportunity to train for Jeopardy host Alex Trebek. What was that like?
Oh, that was great. Alex, you know, he wasn't into the horses that much, but he had bought a farm as an investment, so he got a couple horses, and I was lucky to get Reba's Gold for him, and he came out of the Barrett sale, too, the two-year-old training sale, and it was a lot of fun. He wasn't the greatest horse in the world, but, you know, he won the Seabiscuit Handicap and some other stakes, and we actually took him to Japan to run, and Alex came over, and we spent a week over there, and it was a lot of fun. You know, he's like any of these guys. You get him away from the publicity and the cameras, and, you know, they're just like us. They're just guys that, you know, like to have that outlet of being away from the TV shows and that thing kind of thing. And he was a kick to be around. A lot of fun. And I actually trained for Ed Friendly that produced Laughing and Little House on the Prairie. So he always had movie stars coming out. So that was pretty neat.
Yeah, he was a fantastic owner for many years. He really supported racing and had several different trainers. Didn't your sister Jackie train for him as well?
She did. He'd always have, you know, 2 to 5 trainers because he had a lot of horses and liked to keep us on edge a little if you want to put it that way. And, but, you know, I was lucky. I got bought out of the first Barrett cell there was, Gray Sloopy. And he set a track record and won 8 out of 15. And he was a really one of my all-time favorite horses because he was, besides Brother Derek, he's the only horse that really scared people out of the race. When I entered, they wouldn't even enter. You know, it just was that good. And, you know, when you get those kind of horses, it's very rare and unique.
Dan, only about, believe it or not, a minute and a half left in the program. But I always like to end by asking trainers to tell us a little bit something different about themselves, maybe what you enjoy doing as a hobby outside of horse racing when you can get away.
You know, it's hard to get away, but I like playing poker, hold'em, and no limit hold'em. But you know, it's not easy to get away and play. It's a time consuming game, but that's always fun. A few of us trainers get together, an agent, and do that a little bit. I used to like to, you know, race the motorcycles and ride go-karts, but it's not so easy to do that anymore. But, you know, basically just dedicated to working, and I got a great girlfriend right now that couldn't spend enough time with. But, you know, it's a time-consuming job, and you don't have time for a lot of outside interests. So, you know, you get a couple and spend as much time with them as you can, and mostly I got my 3 boys, and I couldn't ask for more than these 3 guys. So I got no complaints.
Well, Dan, neither do we, because this was an amazing hour. And can't thank you enough for taking the time to be with us. Like all of our guests who appear on Trainer Talk, you'll receive a gift from one of our sponsors. It's Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We will get those out to you. And again, thanks so much, my friend, and continued success.
I use them, so I appreciate getting some more.
All right, cool. Great talking to you, Dan.
All right, you guys take care and good luck at the races.
You too. Dan Hendricks on Trainer Talk. Don't forget, if you missed any portion, go to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast at your leisure. You can also do it, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. We're back next week with another edition of Trainer Talk. You can catch us every Wednesday night, 6 to 7 Eastern. For our producer, Lee Dallapina, for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. We will talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fakes at Tipton.